Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today's interview is going to be with Brett Nicoletti, who is the director and editor in many other hats, but we're talking to him as the director of the award-winning documentary, The Running Man of Pasadena, which took home the Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2018. And you may have heard me say something like this before, but I love documentaries, and it's always really wonderful to see not just a well-made documentary, but an inspiring one. Look, we need all the documentaries that bring us down and show us the horrible things going on in the world, but we also need the uplifting documentaries that show us what's great in the world. And The Running Man of Pasadena is definitely one of those. So I always want to say, watch the film. It's at discoverindiefilm.com. Brett released it around the same time this podcast is going out. They were supposed to go out together, but I kind of got swamped and blew it. But anyway, let's forget that I blew it. Let's focus on the fact that you can watch The Running Man of Pasadena and then listen to this interview with the great guy who made the film. And then after the interview, I'll talk about the film festivals and other things. Oh, wait, before we go, I'm really happy to say The Running Man of Pasadena is going to be part of season 2 of the Discover Indie Film TV series that will be streaming on Amazon Prime Video on October 1st of 2019. Okay, so no more introduction. Let's talk to Brett Nicoletti.
I loved movies as a kid. I always loved movies, but never. I grew up in Massachusetts, and so there was never a moment where I considered it as a possible career. I come from a conservative family in eastern Massachusetts, so they were all business people or blue-collar workers. So,
yeah, no, the arts were just not thought of.
No, not at all. It was never even, I didn't even think about it. I loved watching movies. I watched them all day, every day, especially in the summer, cable and VHS tapes and recording stuff and that sort of thing. But I didn't realize that, I never had thought about it until I went to college in Vermont and I was a business major. And I took a film class my second semester senior year and was just like, wow, this is like,
it was like an arts prerequisite kind of situation.
No, I had an elective that I hadn't used, and a friend of mine and me saw this film class and we're like, let's take films, like film 101. But it was you know, it was project based.
So it was production based. It wasn't like just studying and watching.
Right. No, it was, we had a Super 8 camera. We shot little Super 8 films, and we had, we did tape to tape editing with VHS tape.
And the controller in between two decks.
Yeah, that's right.
Old school.
Yes. And I made two little movies. One of which was completely trashed by my professor, and the other of which he liked.
Which one?
The first one was a video, and it was so I went on spring break to Mexico with a bunch of friends of mine, and I just like did like this like cheesy
MTV. And that's what
MTV.
Your professor didn't like?
Professor hated it. And I used like Let It Be by the Beatles, and he was like, he was like a 60s guy. He's like, no way, you can't use it. It was a complete terrible decision. I thought it was great. And then with the Super 8 film, I just did this little film in my apartment with a friend of mine of him going outside to play baseball. And I really kind of got into the setting up the shots properly and, you know, thinking about the editing as I was shooting, you know, having him leave frames so that I could have a cut point. And the professor loved it, thought it was great. I really enjoyed the film cutting part of that project, like actually throwing the Super 8 film onto a little film bed and doing the cuts and actually taping the film together.
Yeah, the old-fashioned flatbed with the reels. And
yeah, it was it was really fun. I really enjoyed it. And so I had a friend who went to Yale, and he was a high school friend, and he had told us since he was a sophomore in high school that he was moving to California. Like, that was it after graduation from college, he was leaving. Like, the weather was just like, there was no way. Was it just the weather? Yeah. He wanted to be in Southern California. And the plan was still happening. And I just, I had seen, there's a producer, his name is John Killick. He produced a bunch of Spike Lee movies. He produced Dead Man Walking. And he was a Vermont grad. And he came to school and did his speech just after Dead Man Walking about the movie and what you needed to do to be in the movie business. And he basically said, you have to move to New York or Los Angeles. And I had been working in Boston in the summers at Fidelity Investments, and I absolutely hated it. And this, I had a job offer. This was my career path.
You were getting your BS in economics, and you had your job lined up, and it was...
That was it, yeah.
You were not looking forward to it.
And I hated it. And it was valuable work because of that. You know, I realized how much I hated it, and I loved this film class. And a friend moving to California, a successful film alumni telling me that you have to move to one of these cities. And so I said, well, the hell with it. I'm just going to go with Mark to L.A. and see what happens. And so that's how I got here, and I just started hustling around. I ended up in getting a PA job in a small little edit house that edited TV commercials. And I became a TV commercial editor within a year and a half, and I did that for... I'm still doing it. You know, I'm still a commercial editor. I've been doing that forever.
You discovered in that class you had an editor's mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't... I got a PA job when I was here. I was working as a grunt on a shoot. And one of the producers looked at my resume and she said, you have a lot of computer experience. You should look into post-production. I was like, oh, yeah, I liked editing. And so then I just called every week. There was a book called the LA 411. You remember that?
I do remember that book.
I opened that because we didn't have, I had email, but it was super remedial. Like, there was no web searching. So I had that book and I opened it up and I just looked at every post-production company that was in that book and I called every single one of them and got this one call, that one interview.
Right, that's when Avid was taking over.
Avid was happening, yeah, for sure.
Definitely computer skills were... Yeah, editors without computer skills were starting to have a problem.
Yeah, and the Avids were $100,000 machines. Yeah. So, you know, you couldn't put your hands on one unless you had, a nice editor who was willing to share. And they allowed me to kind of figure it out on my own when they weren't using it. Very quickly I picked it up. And then I got a job at another company, and they just had so much. They had 5 directors and 2 editors, and there was so much work happening, director's cuts and spec spots and whatever, that stuff needed to be edited, and I was just able to quickly start building a reel.
Yeah, you may not know, but you're making me want to ask, I bet that the commercial industry, making commercials, they adopted computers much faster because they need the quick turnaround.
Maybe.
I mean, it's so much faster.
Yeah, maybe.
The speed at which commercials are made and how quickly they want them to come out of post.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, I'm just thinking how long it took to get a commercial cut when it was on 35.
Right, so when we started, it would be... Because they were still shooting film. So it would transfer the film. We'd have dailies, proper dailies. They'd be on 3/4.
Oh, the EDR is the editing reports, and then they'd recut the negative
to... Yes, that's right. So we would get...
EDL.
That's right. 3/4 inch. The film would be transferred to tape. We'd digitize the tapes, which I would do, and that would take however long the
however many hours they shot,
3 hours of footage for a 2 30-second commercials or something like that. So I would digitize it all, organize it all, hand it over to the editors. Back then, editors would be given 3 days, 4 days to put a rough cut together. Then the advertising agency client would come in. They'd spend a week, 7 days revising, sending to their client, getting submission. And then you'd have a finishing process. You'd have approved rough cuts. You have a finishing process where you color correct the selects that are used in the commercial. Transfer those to a higher quality tape. Then send those to a different artist who would be the conform artist, who would then take the high resolution footage, ingest it at 1:1, because our Avids couldn't do 1:1. Our Avids could only do 30:1, 20:20. I mean, our rough cut resolution was awful. I mean, you could barely see it by today's standards. The standard definition, low resolution, our drives were 9 gigabytes.
Yeah.
You know, and that was like major. That was a real, you know, and they were huge. They were, put 3 books together, super heavy, very delicate. So you had
to die all the time, right?
Well, yes, they would die a lot. Yes.
Yeah.
So you had to have a special machine that could actually ingest this material at 1-to-1 resolution, and then put that together, put whatever graphics, visual effects, if that was happening, and then send those to the TV stations. But now it's like a whole different.
It's lightning fast. You get stuff and you have to turn around.
I get probably like half a day now to put a rough cut together.
Really?
Yeah, in some cases. I will have dailies handed to me at 9 a.m. and clients will be showing up at like 3 p.m. or at least the director. Or I'll be expected to post an edit by the end of the day or something. And so now I'm screening footage. I mean, it depends, you know.
It explains why your doc is so well edited.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I assume you gave yourself a little more time.
Yeah, more time for that, yeah. it depends on the project, but now I'm screening footage at like 3x, I just like fly through footage trying to find like, where's the job? That's where they look to the left. Okay, put that in there.
Right, so your brain and your eye is trained that you can watch footage fly by.
Yeah,
and
it's not ideal still. If the footage is shot at 120 or 60 frames per second or something like that, ideally, or anything, you should be watching it. Like if I had my druthers, I would spend proper time and pull my selects. But if I know that I've got to get a cutout in 5 hours, then I can't.
Right.
And then as far as finishing, I'll just do the final, on my laptop, I'll just do the 1-to-1 high def final output and send it to, because sometimes it's just for the internet or so it's a whole new world than it was when I started.
Crazy.
All
right, so as you're learning these skills, are you playing with video cameras at home too? Or
no, I never thought editing. I would be directing. I never thought of that. Yeah. I would be a director. Quick sidebar, I moved to New York in 2001. Got a job in an edit house there, and I started working with a documentary.
Like early 2001?
Like September. I moved. My first day of work was September 5th or something like that.
Really?
So 9/11 was my sixth day of work.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it was crazy. We were just back there. I went to the 9/11 museum with my son last month, and it was brought back a lot of it's surreal. It was a very surreal experience to be there, on that day, and then afterwards.
And to be new to the city.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure as a Boston kid, you visited New York a few times.
Not really. I had, because when I was living in LA, I had friends from Vermont who lived in Manhattan, so I would go visit them. So I did. I was familiar with New York from that. But when I grew up, Boston, New York, my parents were. Yeah. We weren't travelers. We didn't go to New York. I've taken my kids to New York 10 times, and I never went there as a kid. So I went to the Yankee Stadium, but that was in the Bronx, so it wasn't really all the way into Manhattan.
Yeah.
So
you moved back there as an editor?
I got a job out there. My wife was from New Haven, so we tried to make it work on the East Coast. So I started working with a documentary filmmaker who shot doc style commercials, and that was the first time I was ever exposed to documentaries as part of my work. And I had been working with a comedy director and a lifestyle guy. Those were the two guys that I had, and visual effects directors. And that was just my experience and what I was used to. And then I all of a sudden was working with this documentary director, and not only was he just like an amazing person and just a wonderful man and just a really, he's still a very good friend and mentor, but the projects were so much more exciting. I just found them to be, you could just, you were doing the storytelling in the edit, as opposed to you getting a set of storyboards and the wide shot goes first and cut to the close up.
Right, because documentary is found in the edit, mm-hmm. pretty much. That's where the story comes out.
Yes, I mean, when you're doing a commercial, you kind of know what you want, but still, he would go out and just shoot a bunch of stuff, and then he would interview. You know, he was a commercial, so it would be like Humana Insurance, you know, and he would go to Humana and he would interview the VP of whatever marketing at Humana, and he'd get a bunch of stuff, and then we would put it together. And we did this 6-minute piece for Herman Miller, and he interviewed a bunch of furniture designers, and they talked about their passions, and we put that together, and it was just really a lot of fun. You know, the guy who designed the air,
right? He must have been. Really well, highly regarded to be handed commercials and being given that free reign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, sometimes that was what the agency brief was. They wanted a documentary. They wanted to cover their client's world as a documentary.
Right. Give it some veritas.
Yeah.
Give it some.
Yeah. So that was my first exposure. But even then. I moved back here. I started working with a company called PsyUp, who has been an amazing client of mine for ever since I moved back here in 2005. But they're visual effects animation, very high-end visual effects animation company. They do beautiful, amazing work. We won the Emmy. They won the Emmy. I was part of a team that won the Emmy for a Coca-Cola commercial in 2008, and I've cut with them many amazing commercials that have been, you know, screened all over the world, and it's been an amazing experience. But the part of that story that's important to my story is that I got off of the documentary train as soon as I moved back here, because I was working, doing so much visual effects work. And about 10 years into that, I was eager to get back into the documentary space, and part of my decision to start directing was that it felt like it was the only way I was going to get there.
Oh, really? So you said
I just didn't have a
you
reel.
Weren't really,
you know?
Going to get. You weren't going to have the opportunity to be involved in documentary style commercials or anything.
Because I didn't have the experience. You know, like, yeah. I didn't have a fresh documentary reel to show people.
So,
you know, films for that matter. I got to a point in my career where I wanted
to
start.
You were so good at what you were doing that you couldn't change.
I couldn't get out of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm just at a point now where I really want to make a difference with my work, and not that visual effects work isn't important and exciting and artistic and creative, but for me, shining a light on people who are doing good work, inspiring other people, the opportunity to inspire somebody else with somebody's real story is what I find the most exciting. And my career is, you know, I don't know how many years I have left to do this. So I'm, you know, I better start doing
what
I really
want to do.
So it
wasn't just the documentary style that you were drawn to. You're also drawn to having a higher purpose of sorts.
Absolutely.
Maybe life having a little meaning.
Yes.
Maybe. I think.
Without a question.
We're around the same age. I might be a little older, but I get it. It was, you're like, you know what? It's time for something I truly care about.
That's right. That's right. So that's what kind of turned me towards that direction. In the meantime, I've started picking up documentary projects. I edited a film called Breaking Two, which was about Nike's attempt to break the 2-hour marathon, which happened a couple years ago now. They commissioned three of their A-list East African marathon athletes, and they staged this event in Milan, and they broke all the rules as far as what city marathons allow you to do, so it wouldn't have been a sanctioned world record.
Right.
Wouldn't have counted.
But it was same distance,
but it's on a Formula One racetrack in Italy, so flat, 5 o'clock in the morning. They had pacers, special hydrating. So they had guys on motorcycles handing the runners
their fluids. So they wouldn't slow at all to grab a cup.
Exactly. Everything was right, perfectly dialed in. And the winner, the guy who won the race, Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya, came 25 seconds short of breaking the 2 hour.
Oh, really?
2 hours and 25 seconds. But wow. But that was
a, and I was the shoe technology better? That's the least important question for an interview about your filmmaking.
But it was a Nike film, right? So
yeah,
ultimately that was a big part of the movie because they wanted to let everybody know that there was this new shoe coming out. It was going to make you 4% faster. That was kind of what the
right. And it was his best time ever. Of course, under those conditions, he might have been able to do it in 20-year-old Adidas, but.
Yes, or who knows, right,
I have
exactly.
No idea, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this is the greatest marathoner of all time. The guy is, he just broke the world record last year, and he's just a remarkable marathoner. But yeah, it's still, that still holds as the unofficial fastest marathon ever run.
Right.
And you
edited it.
I edited that, it was a 1 hour special for Necio, so I cut that, and it was a, you know, Fast and Furious 12-week edit, and it was a 1 hour special, and we were jamming all around.
And about runners.
About runners.
I'm seeing a pattern.
Yeah. Yes. I had worked with the director on some Road to Rio promos for Olympic athletes, and he knew I was a fan of distance running, and he dialed me up when he got this project because he just naturally thought that I would be more interested than the next editor because I was interested in distance running.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are a runner?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't run like
no,
my
you're not
subject.
An extremist.
No, but yes. Yeah, I'm a hobbyist.
Cool. So then you decide to direct, or you got the itch to direct?
I was trying to figure out, yeah, so The Running Man was I moved to Pasadena in 2006, and I started seeing him immediately, as soon as I moved to the city. And as a runner, I was always curious about what his story was. I mean, he's just such a colorful, gregarious guy that, and I would see him everywhere. And he had this thing that said the Running Man of Pasadena on his shirt and his hat. And he was always waving to everybody, and he just stood out. And I was always curious about it. And so that film started coming into my head when I started thinking about shooting. And I ended up doing a few videos for some nonprofits. I produced and directed a video for a traveling performing arts educating group called the Young Americans. They travel around the world and they expose public school students to arts education. They came to Pasadena, and I shot a little video for them, just volunteered. And they said, sure, come on down. And I went down there with a couple friends, and we shot, and I cut that. Then I, through a friend, ended up directing and editing four videos now for a charter school in downtown LA that services the Latino community called Value School. So I started getting gathering some chops, you know, and gathering some gear as I was doing these nonprofit videos. And eventually I walked up to Hike one day. I saw him on the streets, and he was running, and I just dropped my daughter off at school, and I stopped and asked him if he would be interested in making a film together or even talking to me about one. And he was in, you know, I mean, he was said sure. And,
yeah, I mean,
it started our journey. Yeah.
Right? It's almost surprising that you were the first person who approached him about a documentary, because he is such a pillar and such an obvious subject of positivity, you know?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, there's a young girl in the movie. Her name's Jillian Chamberlain, and Hike had, halfway through our shooting, and we shot couple days in 2016 and then a handful of days in 2018.
Right. And you just had the equipment, you were good to go. And you
the first 2016 shoot, I borrowed cameras and everything was borrowed. Sound equipment. And then I had put it aside. I started cutting it, and I realized very quickly that I didn't have a movie. It was just I had his interview, and we had filmed him running through the streets of Pasadena. And it just wasn't what I was hoping for.
You didn't have
for.
A story.
No, there just wasn't. It wasn't a story there. And so, and then I got busy, and I just put it aside. And there was a 6 month probably period there where I was worried that it wasn't gonna happen, like I wasn't gonna finish it. And then my mother-in-law sent me this thread on Nextdoor that somebody had written about him, and then all these people had popped in saying somebody needs to make a documentary about this guy. he's so lovely, all these great things that people were saying about him. I grabbed a couple of screen grabs and put them in the film. And at that point, I realized I need to start talking to the community. That's what I don't have, you know? And so Heike told me that, this girl interviewed me the other day. And I said, at first I was concerned that somebody else was going to steal my thunder. And then I found out that it was a seventh grade girl, and she had interviewed him for her school project. And so I called her and asked her if she'd be interested in being a part of the film. And it turns out that her dad is a sound engineer, and forever he had been planning on shooting a film about Heike. He was a fan of, and the reason why she reached out to Heike was because her dad loved him so much, and her dad wanted to make a movie about him. So it was just funny to get Jillian involved in the movie. She ended up writing the last song. She's a piano player. She wrote the last song for the film, and then her dad did the sound mix. So it was totally
right. So became collaboration. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was no territorialism, mm-hmm. which is nice.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah. I mean, so once I reached out to a couple more people on the Nextdoor thread, got them on camera, and then Heike was going to run the marathon, and then he got injured.
The injury is funny because it really adds a sense of drama to the story.
Yes, yeah.
All of a sudden you had a can he or can't he make the run story.
Yeah, yeah. It was, I remember when he told me about it, I had interviewed Hal Weiss, who was the man at the coffee shop in the movie. And I called Heike and I said, hey, I just had this great interview with one of the, Pasadena Pasadena resident who loves you. It was a great interview. And how are you doing? He said, I hurt myself in the half marathon last week, or I can't remember how long it had been. So I had my camera and I was like, well, let me come over and talk to you. And so we went, and it was raining. I mean, it was from a cinematic standpoint, it couldn't have been more appropriate. We're standing in his garage, the rain's pouring down, he's freezing. And he's telling me about his injury.
He's sad. And, yeah. A man who's normally so full of life is like, his hip.
Yeah.
His hip's messed up. And that's rough when you think of an older gentleman.
Yeah. Yeah. And it still hurts. He's still, in fact, he is now, I was at his house a couple weeks ago, and he's running like once a week now, like 5 miles. Like he can't. I think he's got arthritis in his hip. I think that's ultimately what is going on. But when I spoke with him 2 weeks ago, he was going to see a chiropractor. He's determined to keep going. He will never stop. He will, that's what he says. But how far he'll be able to go will be, is left to be determined. We'll see.
Right, right. He can do 5-minute runs every day or something.
Mm-hmm. And he doesn't like walking. It's not the same.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just a driven.
Yeah.
He is the running man. It's his identity.
Yeah. It definitely is. And
so you shot him on the sad day that he got or gave you the news. And then that gave you your can he do the marathon story.
That's right. That's right. So I started talking to him. I had now had these three interviews with the residents. Talked to him that day when he was injured. And so we then spent, it was probably 2 months. I can't remember. Was it 4 weeks? Maybe a month before the marathon. I mean, he was signed up and he was going. So I had always kind of wanted, I knew he ran it every year. I'd always kind of wanted to follow him. And so I figured this year was as good as any, and then went to the marathon, had a great day. It was a wonderful, really, really great run for him, and it was a great shoot. I mean, he really gutted it out. I mean, he was really hurting the last 8 miles, probably. Finished slowly.
He was hurting longer than most people can run on anyway.
Yeah. And, but he was all smiles, you know, every time I saw him. I took him to the starting line, spent the morning with him. I had one of those little Osmo cameras, you know, those little GoPros that have the three arms that keep it steady.
Mm-hmm.
They're all over the place now. And I had one of those for I met him at 15 miles and I ran with him for a mile. And then I got to the finish line and I had a press pass to get to the actual finish line. And I didn't get the ideal shot for his finish, but I got him finishing. And then I got to walk with him in the pit.
Yeah, he got the arms going up.
Yeah. He was substantially slower than he normally would have been because I think he was... he said he didn't walk, but he was probably running at a walking pace for a lot of it.
Right, so he's a guy who... Even though he's running for the joy of it, he tracks his time. He's aware of what his marathon time is compared to other years.
He's definitely aware of his time.
I
told him about breaking two, and I told him about this Kenyan who almost broke 2 hours in the marathon, and he said, "Well, how old is he?" And I said, "I think he's 34." And he said, "Yeah, well, I'm 70, so, you know, what I do is harder than what he's doing." So he's definitely got an ego. Like, he's not. So he pays attention to his time. And when I had the camera on him, he ran faster. You know, like, he wanted to be, you know, he wanted to look good. Like, he was aware of the camera. When we shot him in Pasadena, he was almost running too fast. There were times when I was like, "Hey, you know, this is not your normal. I know you don't run this fast," but he was moving. He was definitely, because we would do starts and stops, you know. So we're gonna run up Midlothian and we'll stop at the top and we'll take you over to, you know, Brayburn or whatever. Because I had scouted all the streets I wanted to shoot him on, and so he had plenty of resting time. So whenever it was time to shoot, he would be flying. You know, down the Colorado Bridge or whatever. Slow down, man. This needs to look, you know, like you're...
Next you're going to tell me is he goes down the street in Pasadena and whenever he passes, you know, women in their 20s, he speeds up.
Yeah, hey, exactly, yeah. Well, he's smiling for sure.
Yeah. Well, good for him. That's great. So then you get all that footage and you're... Were you editing along the way the whole time?
I had cut together like all the Altadena Pasadena footage, and I had organized his interview and got it down to the stuff that I thought was really great. And then once I had the other interviews, and then I had the marathon, I actually hired an editor because I was sort of I was busy. And I had spoken to a friend. He said, "Why don't you hire somebody and see what they do with it? Maybe that'll kickstart you into a new, maybe that will help kickstart the edit." So I hired this woman, and I was paying her. So I realized that I had better give her some really good direction, something that I had never actually given myself as an editor. So I finally sat down and wrote the movie, wrote the structure out on my laptop, and I was like, "Yeah, I'm going to start. I'm going to bookend this with a marathon, and I'll have this story in scene two, and scene three will go back to the marathon." And I wrote it all out, and finally, actually thought about the edit in my head rather than just sitting down trying to swim through this footage. And then I handed her this structure. She started working on it, but she was also busy, and at that point, I knew what I wanted, and I just took it right back.
Yeah, but bringing in a fresh pair of eyes that you would have to collaborate with, suddenly you're like, okay, well, now I have to express myself to this person, and then that made you narrow it down.
That's right.
Yeah. And then you didn't need the other person.
No, then I didn't need her. And in fact, she could... She just didn't know where everything was or what everything was or what the best little bits were and stuff. So I was just like, I need to. Ready to go. Yeah. So, and then I just did 3 weeks.
Because you shot a lot of it, but you had a DP or a camera operator too, right?
I had Shelly Gerzi, who's a friend and a wonderful DP. She was with me for the Pasadena
shoot. Yeah, she did great work.
Yeah. And she shoots on Big Little Lies and Transparent. And so she's rock solid, professional. She's an excellent DP. But I shot the marathon, so I made sure I was shooting high speed for a lot of it because I knew my hands would be shaking. It's a little more forgiving. I got what I needed to, you know. And it was fun. I enjoyed shooting.
So after you did the write-out, and then you you were still busy with a lot of work, but you found a little break? Or did you squeeze it in nights and weekends?
I got like a 3-4 week break, May of 2008. Pretty much maybe 3 weeks after the marathon, and I just jammed, and it was just, as soon as I had it going, I knew where it was going, and it came together really quickly, once I had the story that I knew I needed, I was able to just blast through it, and I put one rough cut together, I sent it out to some colleagues, and everybody had very minor. Very, very much.
Right.
Everybody
was I love this so much.
Yeah.
Here's the one little thing if you feel
the
like
the camera's
it.
Shaking at the head of this shot. You could probably get rid of that somehow if you cut, you know. It was literally tiny little tweaky stuff. Nothing. Everybody loved it. And it was, And so I was convinced that I was there. And I didn't have time to do a whole re-edit either. And I was very happy with it myself, which I wanted to make a movie. I finally made a movie.
Yeah.
So I bought some music. I've licensed some music from a couple of music licensing companies and got John to do the sound mix and got a friend to do the color, commercial colorist. So it was all, you know, lots of favors. Another friend did the titles, which were beautifully done.
Yeah.
And you know, there weren't that many, but the ones that are there were you know, exactly way better than I could have ever hoped for. So, had another guy donated a shot of YouTube, LA Marathon video. I had to donate a couple places, donate like there's time-lapse footage of the finish line that Santa Monica TV graciously donated to the Running Man.
Oh, very nice.
And then
you finish it up and
that's it. I started submitting. Sherman Oaks was the first film festival that I got into. Is everything okay?
Yeah, I just spilled water, but...
do you want to...
The funny thing is... Nah, it'll be fine. It's the house was built in 57, so okay. It can survive the water for 10 minutes.
Sherman Oaks was the first film festival we got into. Which was super exciting. It was. I remember calling my friend and saying, "I feel like I now officially made a movie." when we got accepted into Sherman Oaks, because it was like somebody was telling me that I made a movie.
Right.
This is, you know.
Oh, well, you knew you were going to have an audience of people you didn't know, which is kind of cool, I would think.
Yeah, and in fact, it was an amazing experience to sit in a theater and actually have people laughing.
So it didn't show anywhere else
before?
That was
the first time it screened.
All right, premiere.
Yeah.
I wish I could brag that your premiere was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that I programmed because we're so important. But, you know, it was just a timing. You finished, and then it was just a scheduling thing.
Right, exactly.
Our final deadline happened to be right around then, and
yes,
you got it in.
That's right.
And 2 months later, boom, it's on screen.
Yes, then we got into four others, all of Southern Cal, Santa Barbara, and San Luis Obispo, Newport Beach. And
yeah, no, I tell you, I don't understand how the world works because I'm like, what festival would see your film and not be like, oh, let's show that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
It's just such a feel-good thing. And,
yeah.
You know, at film festivals, rightfully so, there's a lot of drama and a lot of serious stuff and a lot of issue films. And, you know.
I think it's hard.
You've got an uplifting one.
Yeah. I mean, thank you. I mean, it's very nice of you to say that. And I'm very grateful for the festivals that I was able to screen at. Obviously, it only got into Southern California film festivals for a reason.
Because of the Pasadena?
I think so. Yeah, I think it was a California story. We were part of the Santa Barbara, California stories block.
It's funny though, because I mean, I realize as a third generation Angeleno, I'm a little egotistical, but you know, there's been little lady from Pasadena, and everyone knows Van Halen's from Pasadena. It's like I think of Pasadena as like a nationwide known entity. I'm surprised that would have been a hurdle.
Because you
think, he's the running man of Pasadena. It's so cool.
Yeah.
And why would they be jealous they don't have a running man?
Yeah. I think lots of cities do. I think it's just very competitive, you know, you know, there's Tribeca has they block out a certain amount of spots for New York City, and the short documentaries are, I'm sure the big festivals get thousands and thousands of these because short documentaries are being produced.
And like every film school student is forced to make two over the course of 3 years or something.
Yeah, and why not just submit it to whatever, and they
get their parents' money to submit.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's just really, really competitive, and unless you hit, you know, a lot of festivals are looking for a specific. They have a direction that they're going with their festival each year.
Theme, yeah.
And so a certain amount of spots are dedicated to that particular theme. And so I don't take any offense by it or anything like that. I'm extremely grateful to have screened where we screened, to have been part of panels with other filmmakers, and I had a really great little experience at San Luis Obispo where there was a ultra endurance athlete and entrepreneur who was partnering with the festival, and we had a little panel where she and I sat up and we discussed running and running movies with a group of local runners, and then we went for a run before the screening of The Running Man. It was a really fun,
like with the people that sat in on the panel. That's neat.
So you know, that it was a wonderful experience, you know, every time it screened it was great, and every time that Hike got to go it was especially nice. He didn't go to all of them, but when he went it was fantastic because I finally got him to stand with me for the last one, because he was very shy. He didn't want to go up in Sherman Oaks. He didn't want to come sit.
Yeah, he stayed in the audience. Yeah, he didn't come up. Which is funny, because as you say, he has an ego. He loves attention.
Yeah.
But I guess that's not his venue.
Yeah, yeah.
But he saw it enough times, he knew no one was going to buy.
And he knew everybody loved it. You know, yeah. And he knew everybody loved him. You know, like everybody was, you know, after Sherman Oaks, people were taking their picture with him. Every screening we went to, that he was there, somebody would ask him to take their picture with him.
Yeah, sure.
And it was really fun to have him there. At the Pasadena Film Festival, he got a standing ovation from the crowd. You know, so it was great.
Yeah, I imagine Pasadena, if word had gotten out, you could have packed a 300-seat theater with people who have seen him over the years.
I know.
Would have been such a cool experience for the whole community. I mean, because not everyone may know it, but I think Pasadena in LA is special as a place with its own identity.
Yeah, it's not LA. It's slightly outside of LA. It has the architecture is a little older. It's got that classic bridge. It's got the mountains.
It's got a little old town section.
It's a little conservative. Like, it's definitely not Los Angeles. It's a slightly different part of LA. And you know, for whatever reason, you know, my social media skills are very poor. So I had a Facebook page for the movie, but I was running it and doing a terrible job. I don't play around with Facebook. I didn't do any of that stuff. My daughter ran the Instagram account for the movie. And we had, I think, maybe a half full theater for the Pasadena screening. We had kind of a rotten time slot. It was like 4:30 in the afternoon on a Friday.
Yeah.
So, or a Wednesday.
Tough.
It was
really
like kind of late afternoon Wednesday.
But believe me, I have utter sympathy. It, getting the word out to a community is the hardest thing in the world now. You know, even the funny thing is, even if you got on local TV, like, people don't even watch the local news anymore. So really, how do you get a community to know something's happening? The answer is, you really can't.
Yeah. I ran the half marathon, Pasadena half marathon this year with a shirt promoting the movie, a big picture of his face on my chest and, the handle, my social handle on the back. Not one person asked me about it, about the shirt. You know, thousands of runners, all local runners, lots of local runners. You know, I figured I would at least get somebody saying, "Hey, what's that all about?" You know, but I didn't get any. So it is. It's very, very hard. But some people are really good at it. You know, it's an art.
It is an art. You know, yeah, it's true.
It's hard to hustle for, and you know, with trying to make a living and trying to get the movie going, and I just did not have the energy to spend 10 p.m.
Yeah,
to
12 you're a
PM
working professional, and you did this as a passion project on the side, so it's not like you're going to drop everything and become a master of PR for a 6 to 12 month festival run.
Yeah, it's insane. It's just crazy. It's crazy, but. We're gonna go, and we're gonna go live on the internet soon, publicly, and I'll push it out to as many people as I possibly can, and hopefully it'll get have a little run, on the web, you know, and people will see it there, and that would be.
And you certainly would expect people to share, especially within Pasadena, but the greater LA area. Anyone who sees it is going to be like, "Hey, you should watch this."
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. It's 11 minutes. It's a little longer than I think people are able to sit for, but hopefully it'll hook
up. Once you're over 60 seconds.
Yeah, forget it. Yeah,
you've asked the average American to pay attention longer than they can.
It's true. It's crazy. Yeah. 11 minutes is actually a long commitment. I mean, you gotta sit down for 11 minutes and
I guess geez.
Spending a lot of time. Yeah, jeez. A lot with your time. Time is money.
Madness.
But it is.
Well, but it sounds like you had a great experience, so you're gonna do it again.
I have two projects that I'm in developing. One is a story of a wildfire that took place in the 90s. I do not have permission to talk to the players just yet. It's a very complicated process working with the LA County Fire Department. There are still active personnel who I would need to be able to access.
And they're within constraints.
I need somebody to tell me and to tell the whole department, this man is allowed to
You can share with him without redaction.
That's right. So I've been speaking with them now I made my first contact last October. And that was with a retired captain. And through multiple different channels, I've now met with one of the members of the crew who was on the fire, and I've spoken with a captain below the chief. I've emailed the chief of the fire department, gotten responses. Everybody's very positive. I'm not a priority. I don't know how much paperwork needs to be filled out or what needs to be done to give me the go ahead. So
yeah, a lot of them may not even know who has the final decision on that to give the approval. You would think the chief would.
It is the chief. And he just needs to. I mean, he's busy. You know?
He has a whole department to run in one of the biggest cities in the world. That happens to have a lot of fires every summer. I smelled one the other day.
Really? Yeah. So hopefully, I'm confident that I'm going to get the nod. But until then, I can't really do
anything.
And that's
another. I mean, not that you're always going to be a local filmmaker, but. Yeah, wildfires is a very, I guess it's the whole Western United States, but I mean, in Los Angeles.
Expanding, yeah.
We're so aware of it.
We're very exposed. I mean, you're exposed here for sure. I definitely am in Pasadena.
Yeah, the Skirball one, we were, I was ready to pack up.
Yeah, you didn't get evacuated?
We did not. It stopped at Mulholland in the 405. Wow. And we're just south of there. North of there.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, this is one that literally happened in my 2 miles from my house, 25 years ago. I'm right at the foothills. But local stories are, there's two things about local stories that I love. First of all, they tell me a little bit about my history and my neighborhood, and the types of people who live there and who have lived there. And I get to meet lots of people who I would not meet, who are my neighbors, who I wouldn't meet otherwise. And the other thing about it is I don't have to travel very far to make my movie. And so...
So you can keep your career going.
Yeah.
And make a film without disrupting everything. Yeah, because if you said, all right, I'm going to go spend 3 months in Seattle.
Yeah.
3 months with no income, and you happen to be a father of two, it sounds like.
That's right, yes.
Can't exactly blow everything off, can you?
No. And so, and this way I can, I've been working on this film from a treatment and sizzle reel. I've been putting together a treatment and sizzle reel, and I was just about to start this project that I'm working on now, my day job. I had 2 days left to finish this five-minute sizzle reel that I was working on for this film, and I needed some footage, and so I just grabbed my camera and ran into the mountains and shot some photography, some kind of photojournalist photo study shots of the location, and popped them into the sizzle reel that evening, and I had my shots, and it was so having that access at a moment's notice is very valuable.
Yeah,
it comes in handy.
Yeah, it works in every way.
And there's stories you could throw a baseball and hit 4 documentary films anywhere in this town.
Especially if you're interested in history too, which it sounds like you are, because LA has a rich history.
Yeah,
I mean everywhere does. Maybe not. A new city in like Phoenix may not be so interesting, but this is
there's stories everywhere.
History. Yeah,
I mean, I've got a. There's a woman who down the street from us, she runs this cookie shop. She's an Armenian woman, and she sells chocolate. We've been buying eclairs from her for 50 cents, chocolate eclairs, me and my kids. My kids now walk down there by themselves, and they go down there with a dollar, and they give her a dollar, and they get 2 eclairs, and they walk back. And she's just the sweetest lady in the world, and I'm sure she has this little tiny rundown shop on Washington Boulevard in Pasadena. I'm sure her little story is beautiful, they're everywhere. They really are. We have parrots in our neighborhood. Where the hell did they come from?
That's an interesting thing. I've read about that, the wild parrots.
Yeah,
like pet parrots get loose and then they start breeding and you end up with like these native parrot wild parrot populations.
Thousands of parrots in our neighborhood.
Yeah
Peacocks, but peacocks too.
Madness.
Yeah.
Very cool. and so documentary is your thing. You're not You really want it.
Yeah.
You find it the most rewarding.
Yes. Yeah. It is my thing.
That's cool.
I am definitely, I like people. I like real people and real stories. And I think that it can be stranger than anything you could ever write and funnier than anything that could ever be written. And I just find them, I done correctly and with the right story, it's the most exciting type of film I can think of.
Didn't I tell you in the intro that Brett was a super nice guy? See, I don't lie. And that's why I really want to thank Brett Nicoletti, director, producer, pretty much the artist behind the great award-winning documentary, The Running Man of Pasadena. I want to thank him for coming in, doing that interview. The next episode of this podcast is going to be him answering the Discovery Indie Film 4 questions, so listen for that. And now let's do the housekeeping so we can get out of here. Discover Indie Film is this podcast where I interview filmmakers from the festival circuit, but it is also now a TV series streaming on Amazon Prime. Just look for Discover Indie Film. Season 1 came out in May, and Season 2, that includes Brett's film, The Running Man of Pasadena, is going to come out on October 1st. So if you like independent films, you want to see self-finance films, you want to see the stuff being made by people who are putting all that they have into what they're doing, Just search for Discover Indie Film on Amazon Prime Video. And I also have to tell you that if you're into social media, go to @DIFWINS. That's where you find Discover Indie Film on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Just go to @DIFWINS. And if you like film festivals, Sherman Oaks Film Festival is coming up in late November. In 2019, it's going to be November 21st through 24th. Film Invasion Los Angeles is every June. And I can tell you, these festivals have the best of the best. If you want to see wonderful films and participate in Q&As and meet people, actors, directors, producers, everyone gets together and it's just a really nice community. Okay, I think I've said enough. Thanks for listening.